She sat still, her eyes closed, listening. No one knew what had happened to Richard Halley or why. The story of his life had been like a summary written to damn greatness by showing the price one pays for it. It had been a procession of years spent in garrets and basements, years that had taken the gray tinge of the walls imprisoning a man whose music overflowed with violent color. It had been the gray of a struggle against long flights of unlighted tenement stairs, against frozen plumbing, against the price of a sandwich in an ill-smelling delicatessen store, against the faces of men who listened to music, their eyes empty. It had been a struggle without the relief of violence, without the recognition of finding a conscious enemy, with only a deaf wall to batter, a wall of the most effective soundproofing, indifference, that swallowed blows, chords, and screams. A battle of silence, for a man who could give to sounds a greater eloquence than they had ever carried. The silence of obscurity, of loneliness, of the nights when some rare orchestra played one of his works, and he looked at the darkness, knowing that his soul went in trembling, widening circles from a radio tower through the air of the city, but there were no receivers tuned to hear it. The music of Richard Halley has a quality of the heroic. Our age has outgrown that stuff, said one critic. The music of Richard Halley is out of key with our times. It has a tone of ecstasy. Who cares for ecstasy nowadays? Said another. His life had been a summary of the lives of all the men whose reward is a monument in a public park 100 years after the time when a reward can matter. Except that Richard Halley did not die soon enough. He lived to see the night which, by the accepted laws of history, he was not supposed to see. He was 43 years old, and it was the opening night of Phaethon, an opera he had written at the age of 24. He had changed the ancient Greek myth to his own purpose and meaning. Phaethon, the young son of Helios, who stole his father's chariot, and in ambitious audacity attempted to drive the sun across the sky, did not perish as he perished in the myth. In Halley's opera, Phaethon succeeded. The opera had been performed then 19 years ago, and had closed after one performance to the sound of booing and catcalls. That night Richard Halley had walked the streets of the city till dawn, trying to find an answer to a question which he did not find. On the night when the opera was presented again 19 years later, the last sounds of the music crashed into the sounds of the greatest ovation the opera house had ever heard. The ancient walls could not contain it. The sounds of cheering burst through to the lobbies, to the stairs, to the streets, to the boy who had walked those streets 19 years ago. Dagny was in the audience on the night of the ovation. She was one of the few who had known the music of Richard Halley much earlier, but she had never seen him. She saw him being pushed out on the stage, saw him facing the enormous spread of waving arms and cheering heads. He stood without moving, a tall, emaciated man with graying hair. He did not bow, did not smile. He just stood there looking at the crowd. His face had the quiet, earnest look of a man staring at a question. The music of Richard Halley, wrote a critic next morning, belongs to mankind. It is the product and the expression of the greatness of the people. There is an inspiring lesson, said a minister, in the life of Richard Halley. He has had a terrible struggle, but what does that matter? It is proper, it is noble that he should have endured suffering, injustice, abuse at the hands of his brothers, in order to enrich their lives and teach them to appreciate the beauty of great music. On the day after the opening, Richard Halley retired. He gave no explanation. He merely told his publishers that his career was over. He sold them the rights to his works for a modest sum, even though he knew that his royalties would now bring him a fortune. He went away, leaving no address. It was 8 years ago. No one had seen him since. Dagny listened to the fourth concerto, her head thrown back, her eyes closed. She lay half-stretched across the corner of a couch, her body relaxed and still. But tension stressed the shape of her mouth on her motionless face, a sensual shape, drawn in lines of longing. After a while she opened her eyes. She noticed the newspaper she had thrown down on the couch. She reached for it absently, to turn the vapid headlines out of sight. The paper fell open. She saw the photograph of a face she knew and the heading of a story. She slammed the pages shut and flung them aside. It was the face of Francisco D'Anconia. The heading said that he had arrived in New York. What of it, she thought. She would not have to see him. She had not seen him for years. She sat looking down at the newspaper on the floor. Don't read it, she thought. Don't look at it. But the face, she thought, had not changed. How could a face remain the same when everything else was gone? She wished they had not caught a picture of him when he smiled. That kind of smile did not belong in the pages of a newspaper. It was the smile of a man who is able to see, to know, and to create the glory of existence. It was the mocking, challenging smile of a brilliant intelligence. Don't read it, she thought. Not now. Not to that music. Oh, not to that music. She reached for the paper and opened it. The story said that Signor Francisco D'Anconia had granted an interview to the press in his suite at the Wayne Falkland Hotel. He said that he had come to New York for two important reasons, a hat-check girl at the Cub Club and the liverwurst at Moe's Delicatessen on Third Avenue. He had nothing to say about the coming divorce trial of Mr. and Mrs. Gilbert Vale. Mrs. Vale, a lady of noble breeding and unusual loveliness, had taken a shot at her distinguished young husband some months ago, publicly declaring that she wished to get rid of him for the sake of her lover, Francisco D'Anconia. She had given to the press a detailed account of her secret romance, including a description of the night of last New Year's Eve, which she had spent at D'Anconio's villa in the Andes. Her husband had survived the shot and had sued for divorce. She had countered with a suit for half of her husband's millions and with a recital of his private life, which, she said, made hers look innocent. All of that had been splashed over the newspapers for weeks. But Signor D'Anconia had nothing to say about it when the reporters questioned him. Would he deny Mrs. Vale's story, they asked? I never deny anything, he answered. The reporters had been astonished by his sudden arrival in town. They had thought that he would not wish to be there just when the worst of the scandal was about to explode on the front pages. But they had been wrong. Francisco D'Anconia added one more comment to the reasons for his arrival. I wanted to witness the farce, he said. Dagny let the paper slip to the floor. She sat, bent over, her head on her arms. She did not move, but the strands of hair hanging down to her knees trembled in sudden jolts once in a while. The great chords of Halley's music went on, filling the room, piercing the glass of the windows, streaming out over the city. She was hearing the music. It was her quest, her cry. James Taggart glanced about the living room of his apartment, wondering what time it was. He did not feel like moving to find his watch. He sat in an armchair dressed in wrinkled pajamas, barefooted. It was too much trouble to look for his slippers. The light of the gray sky in the windows hurt his eyes, still sticky with sleep. He felt inside his skull the nasty heaviness which is about to become a headache. He wondered angrily why he had stumbled out into the living room. Oh, yes, he remembered, to look for the time. He slumped sideways over the arm of the chair and caught sight of a clock on a distant building. It was 20 minutes past noon. Through the open door of the bedroom, he heard Betty Pope washing her teeth in the bathroom beyond. Her girdle lay on the floor, by the side of a chair, with the rest of her clothes. The girdle was a faded pink, with broken strands of rubber. "Hurry up, will you?" he called irritably. "I've got to dress." She did not answer. She had left the door of the bathroom open. He could hear the sound of gargling. "Why do I do those things?" he thought, remembering last night. But it was too much trouble to look for an answer. Betty Pope came into the living room, dragging the folds of a satin negligee, harlequin checkered in orange and purple. She looked awful in a negligee, thought Taggart. She was ever so much better in a riding habit, in the photographs on the society pages of the newspapers. She was a lanky girl, all bones and loose joints that did not move smoothly. She had a homely face, a bad complexion, and a look of impertinent condescension derived from the fact that she belonged to one of the very best families. "Oh, hell," she said at nothing in particular, stretching herself to limber up. Jim, where are your nail clippers? I've got to trim my toenails. I don't know. I have a headache. Do it at home. You look unappetizing in the morning, she said indifferently. You look like a snail. Why don't you shut up?